And we're going to finish off the book of Joshua today. Wasn't my original plan, but when I talked to Matt Mullen, he said, you know, when you go through chapters, especially about 11 to 17, you can cover all those very quickly. As a matter of fact, I will do so with a map. And so it just seemed like a good time to kind of wind down the series. And then this allows us to get into some of these topical issues, which we'll be doing through the summer until we begin with 1 Corinthians in the fall. So if you have questions, we will use some of the questions you asked to actually constrain and put together some of these topics. And at the same time, bring a few others that I know are of interest to you. Today, we're going to not only look at Joshua, but at the end, I added some material because it seemed to me that as we look at both Genesis 12 and especially these final chapters here in Joshua, we see that God has placed his blessing upon the nation of Israel. And so I want to ask the question, well, do we see a blessing in the nation of Israel today? Number two, also, of course, a blessing on the Jewish race. They were God's chosen people. And do we see that as well? And so I'm going to pull some things from a new book by Gary Fraser and an older book by George Gilder. So I'm going to put a little of that at the end there for you. But let's, if we can, begin, because we're going to spend some time today really looking at a number of chapters fairly quickly. And first of all, we'll spend a little bit of time on chapter 12, which kind of gives us a summary of the kings that have been overthrown. And then from chapters 13 to 19, these are just how the land was allocated. So I will go through that fairly quickly, but have two very ominous warnings in those passages that help us understand why Israel never could completely take over the land. Then chapter 20 is on the cities of refuge. Chapter 21 is on the Levitical cities, and I will show you a map on that as well. And then the final chapters are kind of farewell speeches. So if you have a Bible, turn with me, if you would, to Joshua chapter 12, and we can see that here in chapter 11 and 12, we're going to spend a little bit of time focusing on what has actually happened to the nation. And I have here the word of God's, of Joshua's victory in the south, and the southern conquest has now reached the northern conquest. And so now you have Jabin, the king of Hazor, putting together this northern coalition. Now the scriptures don't tell us this, but from the Jewish historian Josephus, we learn that this was the greatest army, interestingly enough, that Joshua ever faces. The best estimates, according to Josephus, an army about 300,000 soldiers, about 100,000 and cavalry, about 20,000 chariots. So this is really the largest and best armed army that Joshua runs into. And yet, once again, we see just very quickly a summary in the first six verses, and that's it. And part of it is, I think, an attempt to show to Israel, if you trust in the Lord and depend upon him, all these battles really are inconsequential. And here we see this to be the case. But I thought we would work our way through some of these chapters to see a couple of things that I thought were of note. And the first one we see in chapter 12, look at verse 7 and see now the land that has been taken by Joshua by the time we have come to this point. And we see, for example, in verse 7, the west side of the Jordan, and I'm going to show you this on a map in just a minute, the whole valley of Lebanon. Then you go down to verse 8, it talks about taking all the hill country as well as in the lowland. It talks about taking the slopes. Those would be the slopes leading up to where today would be present day Jerusalem. Then the wilderness. That would be all the Negev and even where the Dead Sea is. And he mentions the Negev, the land of the Hittites. Verse 10, it talks about then defeating the king of Jerusalem. Although in just a minute we're going to talk about how they didn't actually take all of that land. And then the king of Hebron. Then you go down to verse 19. It talks about the king of Hazor. This was the third and final of the cities that were not only taken but burned. And then you have all the way in verse 22 in Carmel. You know, that's where, of course, Elisha ends up later. And then in the following verse, verse 23, it talks about taking the land in the Galilee. So now you begin to see the extent of this military action. And so in verse 24, you have kind of the summary. And essentially, in 7 years, Joshua and his army defeat 31 kings. Now, if that doesn't give you evidence of God's divine hand, you can begin to see how, in some respects, by the time we get to this, it really is becoming a mop-up operation. They've defeated Jericho, they've defeated Ai, they've defeated Hazor, they've defeated all of the southern coalition, now they've defeated much of, but not all of it, and this is what we're going to find out in just a minute, the northern coalition. And so now as we go through these other chapters, a lot of it is indeed talking about how God was going to then give the land to the various tribes that they were promised. But let's go now to chapter 13 and look at verse 13, because in the midst of this here, it talks about Joshua being old, but still there's more work to be done. There's more battles to be fought. But at this point, everybody seems to be a little bit more on autopilot. And verse 13 has this very ominous statement. We'll see two of these. Yet the people of Israel did not drive out the Geshurites or the Makathites, but Geshur and Makathoth dwell in the midst of Israel to this day. Their responsibility was to drive out all of them, and they were not able to do so. And so this begins to be, if you will, sometimes what we say about this, if you write a novel, is this is foreshadowing. The battles that should have taken place, the various ones that had been, should have been moved away, instead they remain. And so these begin to be, if you will, kind of a thorn in the flesh. These begin to be a problem for the nation of Israel, because they have not been able to completely take over the land. Then we go to verse chapter 14, and we see one of two things here as well. In the midst of all of this, we now see, first of all, Caleb coming back to Joshua and saying, do you remember the promise that God gave to us? Of course, Joshua says, I do. And so now we see his request in verse 6 and following for his inheritance, what God had promised to him. And so that becomes very important in chapter 14. Then when we go to chapter 15, we begin to see the allotment for Judah. And I'm going to show this on a map in just a minute. And that's important because out of the tribe of Judah comes what? The Messiah. Very significant. But again, you have a very disturbing statement, and we see this at the very last verse of chapter 15. And that is, look at number verse 63 of chapter 15. But the Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the people of Judah could not drive out. So the Jebusites dwell with the people of Judah at Jerusalem to this day. Now, a while back, we actually brought some of the people in the examine class over to Fort Worth, and we got to see that movie called what? Jerusalem. And they talked about how Jerusalem was run by the Jebusites. And, of course, as you can see on the notes I've posted here, the Jebusites controlled Jerusalem until David finally defeated them. And you might put this in your notes if you have some notes you're taking here. 2 Samuel 5, verses 6 to 9. And here is where now David has become very successful in fighting the Canaanites and the Hittites and all sorts of others. And here now, he comes against the Jebusites, finally to give Jerusalem to the Israelites. And the Jebusites say, yeah, there's not a chance you can beat us. That's a little bit of a paraphrase, but that's basically what they say. And of course, he defeats them almost instantaneously, buys a threshing floor, and that now becomes the location for what? The temple. But up until this time, and when Joshua is written, they do not own Jerusalem. They have defeated the king of Jerusalem, but they do not have control over Jerusalem. And so we see again two different times where there's these little foreshadowing, these little statements about they were not able to drive out the land. In this particular case, they eventually do drive out the Jebusites, but you can see how this, and in some respects, plays out in the book of Judges, plays out in 1 and 2 Samuel, plays out in 1 and 2 Kings. Let's continue on, though. We'll go to verse 16. And here we see the land for Ephraim and Manasseh. And this would be the area sort of north of Jerusalem. And they give some specifics about where that is actually taking place. Then in verse 18, we see the inheritance of Benjamin. And that was very important as well. But it also is beginning to talk about about the complacency. In other words, they finished much of the job, but they didn't finish all of the job, and now complacency is set in, and now some of the battles that should have been fought are not fought. But in the midst of this, it also helps us answer what happens to the tribe of Levi, the Levites. And go with me, if you would, to chapter 18, verse 7, and it says here, "The Levites have no portion among you, for the priesthood of the Lord is their heritage. And Gad and Reuben and half of the tribe of Manasseh have received their inheritance beyond the Jordan eastward, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave them." And so we begin to see that now we're seeing where many of these tribes are located. And then finally in chapter 19, we see the inheritance for Simeon, for Zebulun, for Issachar, for Naphtali, for Dan, and then of course for Joshua. And so if we can, I thought I'd focus for just a few minutes on this map. If you ever do travel to Israel, whether this new trip that Pastor Graham is going to have, sometimes the guides will pull out this map and help you understand a little bit more about where the tribes are. So let's start on the right-hand side to those particular areas to the east of the Jordan River. You see Reuben and Gad and Manasseh. This will be important because we're going to come back in just a minute. Remember, they already have their land, but then they voluntarily went across the Jordan River and were willing to fight the battles west of the Jordan River. They could have said, "Hey, I got mine. You know, Moses gave us this land. This today would be present day Jordan." But you also can see a little bit later as we talk about Israel, if Israel wants to take back all the land that it had, that's actually on the Jordan side. But anyway, you see Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh. Then on the left hand side, to the west of the Dead Sea, you have Judah. And this is the tribe of Judah, of course, the lineage from which the Messiah comes. In the midst of it, Simeon. But look what to the west of them is, the Philistines. Guess who they're always fighting? They're always fighting the Philistines. As a matter of fact, the Ark of the Covenant is taken at one point and it goes to Ashkelon and Ashdod along that coast there. This is where today we would call it what? The Gaza Strip. That's always been a problem for Israel, whether it was the Philistines back then or the Palestinian Authority of the Gaza Strip there as well. Notice there's also the Edomites and the Moabites and the Ammonites. Israel has always been surrounded by enemies. We'll talk more about that when we come to the modern state. But then when we get closer to Jerusalem, we see Dan, Ephraim, Benjamin. Then to the north, you have Manasseh and some of the other ones like Issachar, Naphtali, Asher. But then notice to the north, you have the Hittites. And even, of course, today, Pastor Graham talking about Syria coming down at one point as well during the time of Elisha. So this gives you a little bit of an idea of a quick summary of really chapters from 12 to almost 19, really through 18 at least. And then if you take the 19 with Zebulun, we have covered now quite a number of chapters, and they're all covered by this map. Now, if you have one of the Bibles in the pew, you'll see a map looks very much like that, and it gives you a little bit of an idea of how those tribal areas were actually allocated. And so, in the interest of time, let me move now to two other chapters before we get to the final ones, and these would be chapters 20 and 21. Chapter 20 is all about this idea of the cities of refuge. And this is described not only in chapter 21, but it is also described in Exodus 21, in Numbers 35, and in Deuteronomy 19. These were six places, and I will show you pictures of that again. And if it's hard to see on the screen, first of all, you can work with your ophthalmologist to figure out if maybe you can improve your eyesight. But second of all, you'll also be able to find them on the website so that you can look at these maps, because I pulled these together from the best sources I could find. And it is interesting because we know where all of those cities of refuges are, but we don't know where all the Levitical cities are. And as you'll see in the map in just a minute, there's a reason for that. Some of them are right where the Gaza Strip has been, Hamas has been firing rockets. And it's really hard to do archaeological work when rockets are coming over from the Gaza Strip to the southern part of Israel. The other part where we we don't know where all the Levitical cities are, up kind of the north. And it's kind of hard as well when Hezbollah and Lebanon and Syria are launching rockets in there or threatening. So if we could ever get peace in Israel, which I don't know that it'll ever happen, some of the archaeological investigation could go forward, but it is a little bit scary. As a matter of fact, last night I was with someone and their daughter is going to the northern part of Israel near Syria to do archaeological investigation. But again, when you're a college student, you're convinced that you're invincible, so I'm glad they're going, I'm not, you know. For those of us that just went to Israel, we had a chance to look in the Golan Heights and look into Syria and see where ISIS was, and that was as close as any of us wanted to get. But nevertheless, that's one of the reasons why in some cases we know where the cities of refuge are, and some of the reasons why we don't know exactly some of the locations where some of the Levitical cities are. But these six cities were there for one very significant reason. That is, if you actually killed somebody by accident, it was unintentional, it was by negligence or whatever, you could flee to that city and be protected, so that this was a way to prevent the Hatfields and McCoys kind of problem, where somebody seeking vengeance against you would actually kill you even though you had not been doing this with any malice aforethought. And so this is what these cities of refuge are, and this is described in some detail in chapter 20. Then in chapter 21, we have the Levitical cities, and these now come to this issue. These were actually 48 different towns along with the city, six cities of refuge, and in many cases these were allocated even before they were in the hands of the Israelites. And again, the original plan was for the conquest to take place quickly and for all the land to be the Jews. But if you've ever read any in 1 Samuel or 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, you recognize that the battles that they are fighting in large part are due to battles that were not finished because of the conquest that took place under Joshua's reign. And by the time you get to the book of Judges, how does that book begin? Everybody did what was right in their own eyes, which I think is a great description sometimes for America today, wouldn't you say? And so complacency had set in, and because of apostasy, some of these which were located either were never implemented or never really utilized. And so here's a map again. Might be a little easier to see on your smartphone, but those in the red show you the cities of refuge. And you can, if you can see the red, you can see there's one in Judah, there's one in Reuben, all the way up there to where Manasseh is. So there were places people could theoretically go. Doesn't seem like there's much evidence in history that many people took advantage of this, could go to be protected from a family member that would want to seek vengeance against you. And then the little white dots, which are the locations or supposed locations of those Levitical cities. And again, if you've ever traveled Israel, you have a little better idea of the topography here. Some are in the plains, some are on the desert, and there were just all sorts of places in which all of those particular cities were located, and that was what was established in the book of Joshua. Which brings me, for the last couple of minutes, into the last three chapters. And these are, in a sense, farewell addresses that were given by Joshua or others in this particular case. And the first we see, as you can see in your handout, was a call or a commitment to unity. One of Joshua's major tasks was to call people together for commitment and worship. Remember, as they cross the Jordan River, what's the first thing they do? They set up stones, they have a time of worship, and so this was a very important aspect of that as well. And these Transjordan tribes, those are the ones which were to the east of the Jordan River, now it's time for them to return to the land that Moses gave them. And if you want to see sacrificial action here, three, or actually two and a half of these tribes, who already have the land, were willing to leave their land, leave their families behind, and go and fight the battles, and now it's time for them to be allowed to return. So we see that as well. And he blesses them, sends them home with some of the plunder from the war. Then we see a commitment to relationship. And here Joshua recognizes now, as he's coming to the end of his years, as he looks back on these battles, looks over those last 7 years alone, he realizes a lot of this was completely out of his hands. And so he recognizes the victories really belong to the Lord. Yes, he had to do his part by mustering together the military. But in many cases, we see either the walls falling down, we see meteorites from heaven, we see all sorts of supernatural actions taking place as a result. And so now we can see that he's coming to his end of years, but also we see the concern about the fact that they are surrounded now by these nations that have pagan cultures, and how easy it is for those, even in the midst of truth, to be, in a sense, seduced by error. If that doesn't apply to some of the things we deal with today, it's certainly the case. Parker and the blacks and a few others, Jill, were with us last night when we were talking about today. Pro Ministry starts our Mind Games Conference, taking place in Camp Copus, all sorts of people flying in. But what we are doing is really preparing these young people as they're heading off to college and going to be confronting some of the pagan ideas of our world, how to prepare them to stand true and to have answers for some of the questions that they're facing. So again, those of you that were with us, and certainly Gary and Deborah and some others were with us, had a chance to kind of pray for, and if nothing else, pray for all these college kids coming from all over the country. We got all sorts of people picking up kids at Love Field and at DFW and all the rest. Last year we had one group of individuals. It was kind of interesting because the mom didn't tell them where they were going. They were just on a little trip, and they all of a sudden pull into Camp Copus, and they said, okay, son, you're going to spend a week here. I know if I told you, you wouldn't come. And we saw a lot of heel marks in the back of the auditorium there from a few of the ones that were brought there in under duress, but at least the ones flying in here knew where they're going. And so be praying for them, because this is a good illustration of how in that day there was a concern by the pagan cultures seducing and deceiving Israel. We face that same thing today in a little different way. And so we see, of course, God's judgment would fall upon those who participated in those pagan rituals. So in the final hour, we, of course, then also in this chapter see Joshua one more time kind of summarizing, if you will, the covenantal history. Turn with me, if you would, to chapter 24. And this is probably, again, one of the most significant chapters and ones that we quote from so often. Because he finally says, you know, there are pagans over here and there's truth here. Who are you going to follow? In chapter 24, verse 14, now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and faithfulness. And then, of course, he uses his own household as a model, and we see that in verse 25. But for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. I would imagine some of you may even have that plaque on your wall, or certainly something that you have said before, because here he says, choose this day who you're going to serve. And I think one of the vicarious lessons we can learn from Joshua is that maybe we need to finish the job, whatever that might be. We need to have perseverance. But most importantly, in the midst of a pagan culture that we're surrounded by, a culture that is not hospitable sometimes to Christian values, sometimes I think we need to choose who we're going to serve. As for me and my house, we'll serve the Lord. Now, in the time remaining, I thought I would answer this question. We see God placing his blessing upon the nation of Israel. We see God placing his blessing upon the Jewish people. Do we have any evidence of that? And certainly today we can look at two ways in which I think we see that they are the chosen people. Number one, by the blessings they have received. And number two, by the discrimination that they have faced. Some of you might have been here when Joel Rosenberg was here a couple of weeks ago. Remember when he was speaking, he said, you know, I'm Jewish, and I'm not so thrilled about us being a chosen nation. Have you seen what have happened to us in terms of all the discrimination, all the anti-Semitism? And I think even that itself illustrates, again, God's hand. So let's look at this for just a minute. If you go back to Genesis chapter 12, you see something very interesting, and that is when God calls forth Abraham, at that time known as Abram, he says, says, first of all, that I will make you a great nation, which was hard for him to imagine since he was assuming that he and his wife were infertile. But nevertheless, he then goes on to say, those who bless you, I will bless, and those who curse you, I will curse. And so we certainly can maybe see not only the evidence of blessing on the Jewish nation, but we also see this anti-Semitism. I mean, think about this. You know, when people have just almost an irrational anti-Semitic kind of attitude, there aren't probably more than 18 million Jewish people in the entire world. There are about 6 million here in the United States, about 6 million in Israel, and about 6 million in the diaspora. To blame all of the problems of the world on the Jewish nation, as has been done by anti-Zionist groups, by Adolf Hitler, by Saddam Hussein, by Hamas, by Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, and on, is really almost irrational if you think about it. I mean, if you say, well, they control all of the wealth, well, what about that? I was reading in George Gilder's book that if you go to Indonesia, Chinese people in Indonesia only are 6% of the population, but they control 60% of the wealth in Indonesia. But you don't have these anti-Chinese rallies, and you don't have people condemning that from the United Nations, and yet that seems to be something that the Jewish people have faced throughout history and even to this day. You know, think about this. Even when the tribes of the southern kingdom, this would be Judah and Benjamin, were in captivity, we see that God promised to restore them back to Israel. And you might want to turn over to Ezekiel 37, because in Ezekiel 37, we have, while in the midst of all of this taking place, an interesting prophecy that took place. Because Ezekiel is there, and it's interesting, you have three prophets at the same time there in that Babylonian captivity. You have Daniel, you have Isaiah, and you have Ezekiel. Now, Daniel lived in the palace, and then you have Jeremiah, who lived a very difficult life, and then you have Ezekiel, with kind of a little bit of a kind of a intermediate one. And so Ezekiel is really living in the, in a sense, abject poverty, suffering perhaps more than many of the prophets did during this time of the Babylonian captivity. And so he prays, and God in verse 37 gives him this vision in which he goes to this valley of dry bones. And in the midst of this here, God explains what the bones are. This is an illustration of Israel. Because we see in verse 11 to 14, these bones are the whole house of Israel. And so then he says, I'm going to open your graves and bring you up from them. I will bring you back to the land of Israel. And so here in the midst of this, he tells them that I am going to return the Jews back to the land. And he even says, I'm going to put sinew, I'm going to put the bones together, sinew, and all the rest, and I will put my spirit in you. Well, some people have looked at that and said, well, that was fulfilled when they brought the Jews back to the land. We read about that in Nehemiah. But think about that. It really wasn't fulfilled then, because it says specifically that the 12 tribes would come back. The southern kingdom was taken into exile. The southern kingdom comes back to Israel. But no, this is a time when all the tribes, Jews from all of the 12 tribes, come together. Well, that didn't happen then, but it has happened now. Because we've had Jews from all over the world come back to Israel. And so some people are saying we may be seeing in our day the beginning of the fulfillment of this in Israel. First of all, with the modern state of Israel in May of 1948. And second of all, the possibility of spiritual renewal. Those of us that have traveled to Israel sometimes get a chance to meet these Messianic Jews. These are Jewish people who now worship the Messiah. You also meet other Jews that are Orthodox Jews. Now, sadly, most of Israel is still pretty much a secular state, but you can at least see the possibility someday that this could be a fulfillment of this prophecy indeed. And so as a result, it says, well, okay, maybe there is a blessing that has come to the nation of Israel. What about, is there any blessing to Jewish people? And I'm going to borrow some of this from a book by George Gilder called The Israel Test. And there are lots, but in the interest of time, I always wanted to end on time, I'm only going to give you a few. But look at this. If not, God has blessed Jewish people. Jewish people only make up 2% of the adult population in the United States. Yet they make up a full one-third of what? The Supreme Court. Isn't that interesting? The disproportionate influence there. Wealthy Jewish people, we've heard that phrase before. Well, look at this. Jews make up a 0.5% of the world's population, yet they account for more than 20% of the Forbes 400 list of richest people. I'm going to go through a few more in just a minute, but even if you say, well, maybe they just got lucky, well, they also seem to be very bright individuals. And that is, if you look at the proportion of people with a Jewish heritage and look at their IQs over 140 degrees or higher, 6 times the proportion of everyone else. Isn't that kind of intriguing? Here's a few more. In the last half of the 20th century, despite pervasive discrimination, think of what it was like, for example, to be a Jewish person in the 1930s. Any chance you're going to win a Nobel Prize out of Germany? Not likely. Out of Austria? Not likely. Probably not even out of England. But nevertheless, Jews won 40% of the Nobel Prizes in the first half of the 20th century in the fields of literature, chemistry, physics, and medicine. By the time we get to the second half of the 20th century, from 1950 on, where there was at least a little less anti-Semitism than had happened before, and where more people around the world were given Nobel Prizes. Nobel Prizes were awarded to Jewish people. They won that 29% of all the Nobel Prizes from 1950 to 2000. Of course, now we're in the 21st century, and so far in the 21st century, the percentage of Jews winning Nobel Prizes is at what? 32%. Does that tell you something? I mean, again, this comes from George Gilder, who's kind of interesting because George Gilder's not looking at this from a biblical point of view. In a minute, I'm going to recommend two books, one by Gary Fraser that looks at it from a biblical point of view, and another one by George Gilder who looks at it really just from a secular point of view. He just says, isn't this kind of interesting? He's not looking at Genesis 12. He's not looking at the blessings in Joshua. He just is reporting the facts. And it's funny to see some of these social commentators. They remind me of the football teams that we've seen before. Where, you know, they march down the field and they get to about the red zone, the 20-yard line, but they can never get it into the end zone. Dallas Cowboys. And so what we need to do sometimes is get it into the end zone. You know, it's kind of like you're almost there, but he doesn't see the implications of Genesis 12 and of Joshua 24 and other passages. But let's look at also not only the success of the Jewish people, but let's look at the success of Israel itself. If you've ever traveled there and looked at before and after pictures, and sometimes when you're traveling in these agriculture areas, these were just huge swamps. As a matter of fact, there's one place where you have this whole city or town, I guess you could say, of Ethiopians, and they were brought in because they drained the swamps. But while they did so, these were individuals that were a little less resistant to malaria, so they came in to drain these swamps. And when Israel began to develop in the 1930s all the way to, again, the fact that it became a nation in 1948, the Jews would come in and buy the swamp land from the Arabs because nobody wanted it. It was infested and there were snakes and there were all sorts of mosquitoes and malaria. And they drained those swamps and made them agricultural areas. And then they actually have become world leaders in desalinization. And so today there is water all over Israel and there are places that are coming back and springing up in ways that never existed before. Israel is also the home of all sorts of high-tech startups, most of that in Tel Aviv. Matter of fact, I had George Gilder on my radio program a while back, and he pointed out that if you look at just the number of patents that were given out, of course, the United States gives out more patents than any other country in the world, but if you look at it per capita, Israel is way above us in terms of that as well. And, of course, also, it has been a benefit not only for the Israeli, but for the Arabs too, because as they live in this land, they have been able to benefit from all the changes that have taken place. And so what I thought I would do for just a minute, because I think we have enough time, is play just a short clip. This is on YouTube by George Gilder. And he's a little older than he was when I first interviewed him, although I interviewed him recently. But, you know, I think you'll be able to follow it along. And this was done for Prager University. And George Gilder is going to take you through just a few of those facts, which again show what we call the Israel test.
How do you respond to people who excel you in invention, creativity, and wealth? Do you envy them? Do you feel their success somehow diminishes you? Or do you admire what they've achieved and try to emulate it? These questions sum up what I call the Israel test. In the 1880s, European Jews settled in Mandate, Palestine, and wrought an agricultural miracle in that desolate territory. Then sparsely populated by a few score thousand Jews and a couple hundred thousand Arabs, the Jewish settlers drained malarial swamps, leached salt from the soils, terraced the barren hills, and planted millions of trees. They massively expanded the capacity of the land and enabled it to support a substantial Arab population. In the two decades between 1921 and 1943, Jews quadrupled the number of enterprises, multiplied the number of jobs by a factor of 10, and increased the level of capital investment 100-fold. Far from displacing Arabs, they provided the capital for a major expansion of Arab farms and enabled a 7-fold rise in Arab population by 1948 to a level of 1.35 million, the largest in the long history of Palestine. In other words, the Arabs came to what would soon be the state of Israel because of the Jews. By comparison, Transjordan, now known as Jordan, with the same geological endowment and four times the land, but no Jews, was able to sustain a population density only one-tenth of the population density of Palestine. Crucial to Israel's accomplishments were world-leading technological advances in the recovery of water through desalinization, drip irrigation, and sewage recycling. Over the past 50 years, Israel has increased its population tenfold, its agricultural production 16-fold, and its industrial production 50-fold, while actually reducing net water consumption by 10% since 1948. This huge expansion of effective water resources enabled the land to support not only more Jews, but also millions more Arabs. Today, the state of Israel, with its astonishing achievements in computer science and other high-tech fields, distills both the genius of the Jews and the misdirected anger of the failed states that surround her. The great divide in the Middle East is not between Arab and Jew, but between admiration of achievement, along with the desire to replicate it, and envy accompanied by violent resentment. People who admire success, who pass the Israel test, tend to be wealthy and peaceful. People who resent achievement, who fail the Israel test, tend to become poor and violent. So again, how do you respond to people who excel you in invention, creativity, and wealth? Do you envy them? Do you feel their success somehow diminishes you? Or do you admire what they've achieved and try to emulate it? The Israel test is the central divide in the world today. How you answer it as an individual, and ultimately how we answer it as a nation, is a test of our own will to triumph over enemies who hate us, as they hate Israel, for what is best within us. I'm George Gilder, a non-Jew who has passed the Israel test for Prager University.
Isn't that something? And again, it's maybe if nothing else, going back to Genesis 12, do you want to favor the nation of Israel or do you want to turn against the nation of Israel? But here, he's just looking at it from just the fear facts. And he's looking at it not necessarily at all from a Christian point of view, but isn't that interesting to just see all the things that have happened in Israel, all the blessings that are there? Well, just before we end, let me also mention that not only have you seen the blessings, you've seen the incredible anti-Semitism, which just from a rational point of view doesn't seem to make much sense. Think of the Jewish people. Just think of the plight of God's chosen people, as Joel Rosenberg reminded us. I mean, this has just been, it's been horrible to be a Jew throughout all these centuries, but nevertheless the case. And even today, you have 5 million Jews, almost 6 million Jews, surrounded by 100 million Arab individuals that in many cases are dedicated to their destruction. So again, it is really one of our friends that we have in the Middle East, and yet look at what they have to endure. If you think about that, even apart from the Arab nations that are dedicated to the destruction, as I put up here, even have the countries in the United Nations that continue to condemn Israel. If you look at some of these resolutions that have been passed in the United Nations, sometimes the vote is 197-2. The two are the United States and Israel. Sometimes it's four, and sometimes we get Australia and Great Britain and the UK. But it is amazing how the nations of the world sometimes seem against Israel. And then you have, of course, Western countries which continue to demand Israel to give up land for peace. Matter of fact, they gave up the land in the Gaza Strip for peace. How's that working out for them? You know, and you can kind of see what they've had to deal with. And so again, there has always been this condemnation of the nation of Israel. You watch CNN or you watch the BBC and you just say, you know, I recognize that not everything Israel does is right. And there are some big mistakes that they have made, and I will acknowledge that. But to single them out is amazing. And I thought I'd post one or two examples of that. The United Nations Council on Women's Rights just a few weeks ago singled out one country as an abuser of women. Now, you might say, what was that? Was it Iran? No, it wasn't Iran, with what it's like to be a woman in Iran today. It wasn't Sudan, where women are summarily executed, sometimes with no evidence at all. It wasn't Saudi Arabia, where you are not allowed as a woman to vote, not allowed to drive a car. You're not allowed to leave your house without a male relative that escorts you. No, it wasn't any of those countries. It was Israel. To pick out one nation of the world as the abuser of women, Israel, because they, in a few cases, had shot women who in many cases were wearing suicide packs, and they singled them out. And I, you know, if you want better examples, you can find them almost every year as you look through the news stories. But I thought I'd end with this one. I've watched what's been going on college campuses, and one of the Ivy League schools is Brown University. And they were inviting an individual by the name of Janet Mock, who is an African-American transgender. Okay, so male that became a female came, I'm not even sure about that, but anyway, he, now she, goes by the name Janet Mock. Now this would be, and was going to speak on LGBT rights. Now that would be a perfect set, right? You know, you've got an African-American, there's a minority, transgender, male, now female, speaking on LGBT rights. They withdrew his invitation and protested against him, now her, because they found out that not only was he, now she, pro-gay, she was also pro-Israel, and that was enough to throw them out. Isn't that amazing? So you have to be right. You have to check every one of the boxes, and one of those boxes is you have to be anti-Israel, or we won't let you come and even speak on something that has nothing to do with Israel. And so if it doesn't show you, I think, some of the anti-Semitism and the reason for why we certainly need to pray for our Jewish friends, but even more so pray for these Messianic Jews, especially some that live in Israel. It is difficult for many of them, and I had a first-hand experience just on our last time over there. He finally said, you know, I'm leaving Jerusalem, I'm going to the Galilee. I mean, it's just so difficult. And if you've ever worked with groups like Jews for Jesus or One for Israel, recognize this is a tough mission field, but nevertheless, it again illustrates the fact that indeed, if you don't see God's hand in some of this, guess I don't know what else I can say other than we can see God's blessing, but we also see the irrational anti-Semitism that has come from that. If you'd like to read a little bit more about this, I know this is a class that loves to read. First of all, from the secular point of view, George Gilder is at the Discovery Institute up there in Seattle, and he has written quite a bit on economic issues, and the Israel test is really just a whole documentation on how every nation of the world, if it want to be successful, could learn a lot from what has happened in the nation of Israel. And you saw a little of the video here. If you want to expand your economy, could we hand this book to some of these presidential candidates? I don't know. But, you know, here, if you want to have success, emulate what Israel has been doing. And more importantly, if you want to have failure, then be like the Arab nations that instead of wanting to emulate the success of Israel, want to instead exercise covetousness and envy and anger. And so, again, it's a secular book, but it's a fascinating look at what I would have to say. Even though he doesn't get it across the goal line, it really shows God's blessing on the Jewish people and the land of Israel. And then a book that is, of course, looking at this from a Christian point of view, our good friend Gary Fraser, the book came out just a couple weeks ago, I mentioned it before, The Miracle of Israel, and it tells you the whole history of how God's hand has worked to Israel, even leading up to the Balfour Declaration, the United Nations Declaration, the division of the land, 1948, the establishment of the nation of Israel, then the successes in the, and Pastor Graham mentioned that today, the 1967 Six-Day War, 1973 Yom Kippur War, enduring the Scud rockets launched by Saddam Hussein, enduring the Hamas rockets, again, shows me that indeed God's hand is still on the nation of Israel. Parker?